Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Star Chamber Show podcast, episode number 118. This is Steven Zimmer, and I have two very enthusiastic co-hosts who actually logged in a good 10 minutes ahead of the showtime. So I was the late one today to get on board there, so I have to give them some major kudos. They're definitely, I guess they're really pumped about tonight in particular, but I will say, of course, who they are, Michael West and Daniel Dark. And so how you doing tonight, guys?
Good.
I'm here.
I'm impressed. You guys were on a full 10 minutes ahead of the showtime here, logged in and ready to go. So that gives me hope that tonight's going to be a really awesome show.
Well, you know, but we've got a lot to talk about and a lot of things to do tonight, so. And
we have a good guest calling
in too, don't we? So
we do. And Michael's going to give a real big keynote speech, which he prepared for tonight. And we are going to have a lot of fun. But where do we begin? Yeah, we will have a guest tonight that will be coming in. It was a late notice kind of thing, but he'll be coming on soon. He's an author and also a lawyer, so it'd be a very interesting range of topics we can cover. But tonight we had talked about getting into a little bit of the nonfiction side of things to kind of segue with a certain new release. Of course, Michael and I love good eating, and I think Michael is also a guy like me that likes ketchup. So of course, when speaking to you, we have to call it catsup because your book is Victorian Catsup, Receipts of the Past, and that is now out in print and ebook and a gloriously Victorian-looking gold and green cover. And congratulations. And tell us about the excitement this week, Daniel.
Well, everybody knows from last week that I finally got to see all the cover last week. Hello?
Michael's got the sound effects going tonight there, I think.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I was reclining my chair.
That was awesome. I thought it was like an actual sound effect. I was like, wow, he's really upping our budget in the show.
I didn't realize you could pick that up.
Hey, that's production
value. Yeah, we picked it up strongly.
That is production value. People think like we got, you know, like a major soundboard over here when you do things like that.
That's the sound of leather against leather.
All righty.
And actually,
I didn't know what it was.
Good, because we have to impress our listeners, and one of whom is already in the chat room tonight, Tommy B. Smith, man, one of the true legends out there, and he's one of my favorites and a great actually guest. He's actually co-hosted and also listens too. So, Mike, you entertained him at least so far.
It's like I need to, like, good evening.
So now back, I should tell Holly, because Holly, she might join in the chat room tonight, but Holly, Tommy B. Smith is in the chat room.
Excuse me,
he is. Holly, you can barely hear Holly there, but she's lurking about.
Oh, no, you can hear chat room. You can hear Holly.
It's hard not to hear Holly. But tell us about the new book, Daniel.
All righty. The book came out in e-form on Tuesday and in print form today, and it is a history book / cookbook on Victorian ketchup, which has about 200 recipes for ketchup and about 60 different flavors of ketchup that they had back in the Victorian days that we do not have basically today. A lot of people are getting back into that type of stuff, and I wrote the book back when I was trying to recover from a stroke, so you know, it helped me get into a position of being able to regenerate brain memories and stuff, so that you know, all the things that I did in the kitchen and everything, I was trying to relearn, basically. And that book helped me get back into it, because I used to make ketchup for different dishes that I was putting on the table. I'd actually have a certain ketchup that I would pair with them. And, you know, this is the recipes that I initialized to make into something more. You know, and bring them up to date on today's standards and stuff. So, and also, you know, it segued into me starting a small ketchup company at the same time, because when I got to where I was able to stand up behind a stove again, I started making the recipes that I had worked with before and trying to get them to where I could put them out in public. Also, when you look at the book, you'll notice that it's not one of those books that, you know, is got the flashy cover, like, you know, a fantasy book or anything like that. It is a pure, you know, the artist and everything that did the cover actually went with my dream of having a cover that represented the type of covers that they had back in the 1800s. And she did a wonderful job on creating that. Along with the young man that helped me edit the book and get it ready for Seven Star to publish. There's a short history on where ketchup came from, you know, different things about it, you know, how it generated to the red goopy stuff that you see on the shelves most of the time now in the grocery store. And one reason that I was working with a building my own ketchup company is when you walk down the aisle of a grocery store, you would find, you know, all different types of chips, all different types of sauces, all different types of mustards, all different, you know, everything. But when it came to ketchup, you had one flavor, and that was your regular tomato flavor that Heinz, Hunt's, and the other canning companies branded as the economy in the United States back in the late 1800s. And I wanted to bring back the flavors that most people have never heard of before, like lobster ketchup and, you know, cucumber ketchup and pear ketchup and different things like that. And those are all recipes that you can find in this book now.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Very cool.
The big diversity there. And, yeah, I guess Michael and I will have to host a bunch of cookouts this summer and start checking all of them off the list and gradually go through the whole book and get them tried out here. But it's, man,
yeah, well,
it's fun to read about them.
Yeah, that lobster ketchup especially sounds...
Lobster ketchup, if you mix it with a butter sauce, makes you an instant lobster sauce for, like, your hollandaise or your eggs or anything like that that you'd normally use a lobster sauce on.
Mm.
And, you know, that's just one of the flavors of ketchup that you'll find in the book. So, you know... You know, whether you're looking at a bayberry ketchup or you know, a cabbage ketchup or, you know, whatever, there'll be different things that, you know.
So did you find? I mean, were these recipes passed down to you? Did you find out about them through research?
These are all recipes that I researched during, you know, when I had my Victorian restaurant, and the cookbooks that I have here at the house and different things like that. Like one of the cookbooks that I've got, you know, sitting on my desk right here is Queen Cookery Books, and it's Pickles and Preserves. And when you flip through it and everything, it's got things like mushroom ketchup, elderberry ketchup, cucumber ketchup, you know, anchovy ketchup, camp ketchup, sweet tomato, you know, it has different things like that in it. So, and these were all recipes that you could find, like this book that I'm looking at right now, was printed in, you know, it was a later book. It was printed in 1902, you know, so, but the recipes that I used were recipes that I'd found and people sent to me that were from 1910 and before, so that I could put them all in the book and not have to deal with copyright or anything like that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. They're all...
yeah, those, the good old public domain issue, yes. Yeah, it's... but yeah, they all fall within that zone easily, but it's kind of cool, though, because, I mean, not a lot of people know that you are a Victorian chef and that, in fact, you know, before, obviously, you suffered your stroke, you had a Victorian-style restaurant. So, I mean, so you're not just coming at this as a fan, but you schooled in this. You ran a restaurant.
Yes,
you are a Victorian chef.
You lived it.
That adds a lot to this book.
You
and,
know.
And 1902 is a bit modern for you, by the way. That's I'm surprised you even can say the word 1900.
Well, you know, I just picked up my car, you know, here recently and everything, and it's a 1901.
Yeah, 1901. He's not kidding, by the way, folks.
And,
he really did get a 1901 vehicle.
And I'm working on getting it fixed up to where it's roadworthy and stuff, and being able to get it out on the road, and being, you know, possibly bringing it to different events that I'll be doing. I would like to do a tour in it, through the back countries of Tennessee, Kentucky, and stuff, and stop at all the little bookstores and stuff along the way and do signings and stuff out of that car. So, it's got a whole 6-horsepower engine in it. It'll rush you down the road with an adrenaline rush and everything that you've never had before. Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, that should definitely make the wind blow through your hair, going at, you know, those kind of speeds.
you might even be able to keep your cap on.
Yeah, you might.
I can. But you know, I do have a nice bonnet on it, so you know, it's, you know, so you're enclosed pretty much.
How many days in advance would you have to leave before an event?
It all depends on where the event is, because it's only regulated to be on certain roads because of the speed that it'll go. A car that won't do over 50 miles an hour in Tennessee, at least, is not allowed on any major highway or anything like that. So I have to stick to roads that are 45 miles per hour or less.
So what do you mean when he's come to imagine area, he'll be heading out September 3rd, somewhere around there, he'll make it by October.
So what's the 1901 equivalent of GPS?
The GPS that I got for it and everything is a little thing that is made out of brass and everything. It's got sight glasses and stuff in it. They call it a sextant. You know, so that you know where you're going at all times and everything, using the sun and the stars and stuff, so and the horizon out in front of you.
Oh man, this is gonna be a lot of fun. So between your special bicycle and then this, I mean, man, you could start almost like a whole amusement park by yourself at these events, Victorian style something. This is going to be a lot of
Ripper
fun.
Ripper World.
Ripper World. Oh,
yep.
My God. There's the name of it. Oh, my God.
What is it? What was that?
Ripper World.
That's what Michael said. Yeah. That's awesome. Oh, man.
Patent pending.
And then... This is good.
One thing about the book, though, that, you know, I haven't mentioned this week is 90% of all proceeds from this book that I get will be going to the Blood Banks of Tennessee in support of what they're doing, because they're the ones that have kept me alive over the last, you know, couple of years. The last few months and everything, they've furnished me with over 20 units of blood personally. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm doing this, this book was a release, not because I don't need the money, because I could really use the money to pay off hospital bills and stuff, but, you know, I feel like I need to do something to give back, and this is one way that I can give back to the ones that have kept me alive and stuff like that. So,
very cool.
But, it's got a great story behind it. It's got a cause behind it. I mean, it's, you know, got a lot of authenticity, obviously, behind it. I mean, it's real cool. I think that's the cool thing about nonfiction. You can really find zones, and I think it's cool that you, as a fiction author, have branched out to do a nonfiction title in an area of expertise that you have. And I think a lot of fiction authors, you know, might have something like that in their wheelhouse area that they, you know, are have professional knowledge of, and it's cool to put out a niche type of release like that that's got a real specialty to it. I mean, and that's I think there's a lot of demand for these kind of things nowadays, and that obviously can go over with, you know, a whole lot of different places. I mean, you can put that in all kinds of, from history to culinary areas. I mean, it's amazing how many different possibilities it has.
The culinary people like it,
if nothing else.
The culinary people like it, and conversation piece.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, it definitely is.
But the culinary people like it, but also the history people like it, and if you write history in the Victorian era, knowing the proper foods and everything is a real, you know, task a lot of times to a lot of authors, you know, when they're writing fiction, because they, you know, they see what they see on TV, but that doesn't give them anything about what, you know, what type of foods was actually eaten and by whom, and different things like that. Well, this is, you know, the books that I'll be putting out of this type will be a cross-reference book of what was actually used in the Victorian era. And, you know, I have looked at doing, you know, a whole collection of these type of books to where, you know, people can sit there and pick them up and say, you know, what type of, you know, how did they cook their meats? You know, what type of sauces did they have? What type of soups did they have? You know, different things like that in this era, so that they know, you know, okay, if I'm writing about this, I can put this in there, and it's going to be, you know, time-wise correct. All that they need to do is make sure it's geographically correct too, because in London they had a huge influx of different products coming from all over the world. But in, say, the Midwest of the United States at the same time, they didn't. But they were still making ketchups and stuff like that in the Midwest. What did they use to make them with? Local products. And, what was grown, you know, when you look at, you know, what was grown, what type of crops did they have to do that with? And by narrowing that down, you would know what, you know, what they had in your stories. So, you know, that is one of the things that I look at doing, and, you know, helping out the other authors and stuff with his books, as well as bring back, you know, a taste of history. You know,
that's fantastic.
And so, but,
well, at this juncture, I want to give, before I bring our guest on, who is on the phone, by the way, I do want to give a quick shout-out to the Pen of Chaos, Tommy B. Smith in the chat room. Holly is there, by the way, and Robert Osborne, and, yeah, it looks like the chat room is getting live tonight, so we may get some comments and questions from there, which is good because we do have a great caller at the moment, and, yeah, he, of course, is author, creative. He's also an attorney, and this is a guy that I think a lot of, and really have enjoyed having him at Imaginarium personally. And welcome to, for the first time, as I told him earlier when we were talking, enter the arena. But yes, he is now on the Star Chamber show. Eric Moser, welcome.
Hey, Stephen. Hey, Daniel. Hey, Michael.
Hello. How's it going tonight, Eric? Speak up. Don't be shy.
Oh yes, yeah. We're fun.
Well, I'm glad to join you guys tonight. I had talked to Holly earlier in the day about a couple topics, and then I'm ready to kind of discuss whatever we want to discuss tonight. And I wanted to hopefully talk a little bit about law in fiction.
Fantastic. Yeah, because that's a topic we don't often get to address on the show because we have not had a lot of authors who are also attorneys on the show. So that's awesome. And yeah, there are some buzz issues at the moment, like we mentioned early in the show, with the you know, the GDPR compliance in the European Union, which of course has, you know, set everybody into panic mode in the author world. Over here in the U.S. even. And so, yeah, there's a lot to talk about. But first, for our audience, though, I mean, I have known you from Imaginarium. I know, you know, Michael and Daniel certainly have probably seen you at Imaginarium. But, yeah, tell everybody about what you do in your creative worlds and your interactive fiction and all that first so they can just get an idea of where you're coming from.
I live in Louisville. I've practiced law for about 17 years now, and about 6 years ago, I guess I got a little of an itch to create something, use the other side of my brain a little bit more than I was, but instead of writing a normal book, I ran across some interactive fiction, just like on the App Store. I was just kind of browsing around, and I found some stories that were kind of a mix between a traditional novel and a text game. And so I downloaded a couple of them, and I really, really enjoyed them. And so I ended up kind of making that my creative project. This was about 2013, was to create a text game to be submitted to the publisher, Choice of Games. And so I spent about 2 years on that first project, and it was finally published in December of 2015.
Fantastic.
Cool.
And that, you know what that reminds me of, and we are big 80s people here. In Daniel's case, I mean 1880s, but in Michael's case and mine, 1980s. but the Choose Your Own Adventure novels, I mean, the choose your own adventure novels that were so big back in the 80s that, of course. That's, you know, now it's a lot more, you know, advanced, but yeah, that does kind of give me a little bit of reminiscence on that. Did you enjoy those originally, or were those part of your inspiration for this phase?
Partially. I'd read, my brother and I were pretty big readers back in the day, and we read quite a few of those. Those were big, like, in the 80s, and so I was probably, you know, 10, 11, 12, kind of that age, and I really enjoyed them. That company actually is still in existence. It's called ChooseCo, and I've actually, you know, kind of reviewed the submission requirements for that company. They take submissions from writers, and they have sold millions of copies just in, you know, this past decade, kind of a resurgence. Lots of publishers, even like Disney and a lot of popular big properties, have decided to, a lot of times there'll be kids books, but they've decided to launch, you know, books that do have an element of choice. They're very reminiscent of the Choose Your Own Adventure books, you know, basically to, like, a binary set of choices So it splits, and you just go to the appropriate page. The interactive fiction, though, has come, you know, a tremendous long way from that, and the limitations of the physical printed page that, you know, a book cannot first of all, you cannot design your character with a book.
Right.
You cannot have statistics or variables or things like that, and the book cannot really remember what you've done. So the electronic version of these interactive fiction stories has all of those strengths, allowing customization of character, remembering statistics, giving you different endings based on your choices, not necessarily did you go down the left hallway or the right hallway.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely there's a lot more complexity to today's, for sure. And, yeah, Michael, you got to be thinking of this for your Legacy of the Gods series, for sure. that'd be a cool playground for this kind of thing, for sure. But yeah, it's kind of cool to hear that they continued and developed further, though, because from those original books. That's awesome. I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that they had kept publishing.
It was one, in back of the day, it was like one guy, like it's like R.A. Montgomery or something like that.
Yeah.
Who just cranked out an ungodly number of those things. And if you read them now, you'll realize they're not great storytelling. Actually kind of bland, but they did have that element of choice, which was enough to hook kids in.
I think the first one I ever read was the Cave of Time.
I think I actually remember that. Oh my God, that's awesome! Yeah, I've got them somewhere in the house. They're somewhere buried, probably under where my old ColecoVision is. But they are somewhere. I one day I will have to find them and impress Eric by bringing my original paperbacks to one of the shows here. But yeah, so that sounds very, very exciting, man. And as far as, yeah, definitely want to get a little bit into the legal stuff. So let's ask you about the GDPR stuff. Have you, you know, it freaked a lot of authors out, with their, especially the ones that work with large email lists. What are your thoughts on this whole thing?
Well, I'm certainly not someone overly well versed. I have read, you know, several articles, in the last couple of weeks about these issues. All I can say is my own approach is that,
yeah, as far as
I think
EU jurisdiction, mainly that's probably the thing that I, as an American based author, I guess that's probably where my most concern is how much how much effect does a EU regulation have on an American author? For instance,
and that's probably a very complex question. The first thought is that, you know, what would the enforcement be, and that's probably the realistic thing to think about would the EU there would be some sort of mechanism in a United States court to proceed, and I just don't think that. Especially independent authors are on anyone's radar. I do think that I've read several articles from MailChimp and some other companies like that. And, you know, some of the standard advice is, you know, maybe consider doing a double opt-in for your email, which, you know, it sort of creates more friction, which is kind of at odds with general sales. You know, you want to close that deal, get that email address, and a double opt-in, you know, makes them basically click twice. But when they do that, you're confirming that the person, it's actually their email, because, you know, in theory anybody can sign up and put someone else's email on your login portal with a double opt-in. The email, you know, that person is going to get another message that says, you know, do you really want to be on this list? And so I think that's probably smart to do. Make sure that you have an unsubscribe, which you should have anyway, and really make sure that you're mindful of the Anti-Spam Act and, you know, the United States law first. That's what you should be worried about. is to make sure that you're doing things the right way here with the unsubscribe, to make it easy, that you've got a physical address listed in your email. That's a requirement. So you know, those things, worry about those things that, you know, could, in theory, subject you to some liability under that federal statute that's passed, that was passed a lot, many years ago. We should all know about it by now.
Right.
But, you know, worry about that. I wouldn't worry about this EU too much. I just don't think there's any chance they're going to go after anybody. At least that's my opinion. And they'd have to enforce it in U.S. court anyway. So, I mean, really, I think people are personally, I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you use a service like MailChimp, for instance, I mean, they really, you know, watch compliance. And so, I mean, yeah, obviously when you do a MailChimp list, you are required to have, you know, a physical address. You do have unsubscribe worked into the equation. You do have many of the things you're talking about. And, you know, of course, there's several similar services to MailChimp. That just happens to be the one I'm familiar with. But it was definitely something that really, really worried a lot of authors in recent last couple of weeks or so, as they neared the I guess the date that it became fully active in the EU. And I wasn't worried that Michael was going to get hauled off into Brussels to have to appear before the EU. but it's definitely a concern. And I'm kind of with you. I was not panicked after reading, you know, some of the basic information and seeing what MailChimp had. But if you're not on a service like that, then maybe you do have to watch, you know, how you process things and do things. But also
how many times have you signed up for something and it says, you know, go to your email and, you know, verify your email, you know, which is a second thing of doing it. And most of us don't think anything about that, if that's something that we're wanting to sign up for. So,
right.
You know, yeah, and I guess you want the anyway, people that want to sign up for it. So.
Right. Right. And especially with an email list, because sometimes in today's world, you get a lot of freebie chasers where if you give away an ebook to sign up for an email list, they'll sign up and then unsubscribe like immediately so that they can get another free ebook to sign up for you. And those unsubscribes actually trigger, there's enough of them, they actually trigger a problem with MailChimp and your account, and that you get a strike if you get too high a percentage of unsubscribes. So that can be, it definitely can be to your advantage to make sure that you have people that really do want to be there. I mean, for sure. So that is a bit of good advice, but, you tell us, Eric, what area of, as far as the legal side of things with authors, what are some of the hot button things to kind of watch these days?
Well, I don't know if I could use the words on this show, so I probably won't, but I'm sure the romance authors if there's any listening, have been following the trademark case. It's been setting Twitter afire on certain accounts, and so I think that's tremendously interesting. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Are you talking about
the
person that tried to copyright or not trademark the one word?
Yes, one word. And again, I think a lot of folks will know what we're talking about. But basically, this author is attempting to trademark not only a font, for a title, but basically an adjective, that might describe some certain men. I'll just say that. And it's a word that could be used in different contexts, and it certainly could be used as an adjective to describe other things or specific people. And so
it might be the name of a Kid Rock album, as a matter of fact.
So that's, you know, and I'll be honest with you, some of these legal issues, they're super interesting. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, if this is what you end up with, you may just end up getting some, you know, more exposure out of this. The people fighting her are getting quite a bit of exposure themselves. and the people that she had targeted, even Amazon got involved to some extent. So, you know, sometimes you don't want to be on the receiving end of a cease and desist letter, obviously. But in this case, these folks felt totally blindsided. I mean, think about if someone tried to, let's say they tried to trademark the term spooky. So if you're a horror author and you can't use spooky in your title anymore, it's not just the Spooky Brothers, it's anything that is spooky. So is that something that you would anticipate? Of course not. So I think this is going to apparently take a while to wind through some different channels. But it's just, you know, it just shows how some authors are getting very, very protective of what they view as their intellectual property or their brand. And some of them are more willing than others to use legal tools in an attempt to kind of gain a competitive advantage.
Now, my question is that if she succeeds in trademarking this, what if you only use, like, take off the Y? Would that be part of the trademark? Well, or would...
From what I read, that's not what she's trying to trademark. She would have the entire word.
Okay.
Again, I don't know how you trademark an adjective. That's a common, you know, usage.
Right.
But yeah, it's the actual word, but it doesn't have the, like, it describes the brothers specifically in her titles, even, is my understanding. But she's just going not for the blank brothers.
I mean, for instance, like when Gene Simmons tried to trademark the devil horns. You know, I mean, how does this not get laughed out of court just when it's suggested?
Well, I mean, it actually got approved, her trademark.
That's what I mean. I mean, I don't understand what merit. I mean, I could see her having merit in trademarking the entire title. You know, like, these brothers, if she describes these brothers this way. Trademarking anything that involves blank brothers, but just the word itself, I don't understand how she can, you know, what, how they think that they can move forward with this.
Well, you know, the consensus, if you just look at people's comments, now these people aren't all attorneys and they're not all publishing experts and they're not all authors. But, you know, the consensus is that this does seem, because, you know, think about, you know, The Amazing Spider-Man or The Incredible Hulk. You can't,
right,
you know, trademark Amazing or Incredible by itself, or The Uncanny X-Men even. You can't generally trademark just a freaking adjective by itself. So, you know, I mentioned the case because I think it's interesting and it's been a hot topic, but my opinion of it's pretty low, and, you know, I'd be happy to see it overturned, because, you know, obviously it just sends a signal to other folks, perhaps people with deeper pockets than other folks, to take an avenue that might cause new authors, authors who aren't as don't have the resources. It might scare them off, and, you know, I don't know if that's the intent or not, but that's what the effect is.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. Did Chicken Soup or Dummies, was either one of those groups of books trademarked? Or can anybody use those if they really wanted to?
I don't know, but I would bet money that they are. I mean, for the whole Four Dummies, because you even, look, I've even got a Investing for Dummies book here in my library. I'm looking at it right now. You mentioned that. And they've got the Four Dummies part. They've got the kind of yellow, I'm sure they've trademarked lots of aspects of these books, but I'm pretty sure that the Four Dummies and Chicken Soup, because you even have, like, Blanks for Dummies. You have the same sort of setup in the title every single time. I would assume those are trademarked, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but most people don't use it because they know, you know, that was somebody's, you know, baby, basically.
Well, taking it back to interactive fiction real quick, like, people can't, I don't think, can use Choose Your Own Adventure. I'm
I would bet money that phrase is probably trademarked. So you have to call it a choice book or something, you know, different.
Pick your path.
I'm
something different.
Choose Your Own Adventure is protected. Yeah.
Well, on a slightly different vein, I'm sure that you've heard about the embezzlement case with the literary agency where the accountant embezzled $3.4 million.
I heard a little bit, but I'm low on details on that one.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if
I haven't heard anything about it, so.
Oh, okay. Well, there was a Manhattan accountant who, it was the literary firm that represents the estate of Mario Puzo. You know, they've got some big name authors there. And so this accountant faces 20 years in jail for wire fraud. For embezzling $3.4 million from what's the agency? Donaldo and Olson, I think. But my question is, you know, if something like that happens, if an author suspects that they're not getting their fair share under a contract, or that there's some sort of nefarious bookkeeping going on, not pointing any fingers at anybody I know, but if an author were to suspect,
be careful, Steve.
That if an author would suspect that, you know, they're not getting what is actually due to them, and somehow through creative bookkeeping and whatnot the proceeds are being hidden from them, what kind of legal recourse do they have?
Well, I mean, that sounds like classic fraud, conversion. I don't know if that fact pattern, if they've been given false sales data. Like, you know, my publisher, every month, and it's a little different, I guess, with this industry, but I get a detailed breakdown of all sales. I get that every
right.
month. And so, you know, if I felt like that was you know, doctored in some way. I mean, that's difficult. You've got to get to the raw data, and I'm not sure. I mean, do you all actually have access to the raw data when you go through a publishing house? Like we can use things like App Annie that are a third party, you know, a service that can pull data from the app stores, for example. So there is some way to get some raw data and compare it before you start making allegations. But do you all have that sort of capacity?
Well, I can't speak for all authors. I know I get from various publishers that I deal with, I get you know, either quarterly or annual statements with regard to sales and royalties and whatnot. So yeah, that would be the thing, is that you'd have to get some kind of proof to show that, you know, what you're getting is not the true figures.
So if you're talking about, like, if you're looking at your Amazon positions, things like that, or you're looking at just, you know, you're getting a decent amount of emails, or just any kind of indicators that that sales anecdotally would appear stronger. But like I said, I have access to data from a third party that's not the publisher. So I kind of have another place to look. If you're just looking at anecdotal evidence and I guess a gut feeling, I don't know how do you even start with that.
Right.
Because you wouldn't have. I don't know what your contract states. I don't know if your contract would have a provision
in
there.
I think most contracts have in them, you know, that you can go to a mediator or something of that nature. You know, luckily, knock on wood, I've never been in that situation. But I was just curious, with this being in the headlines and it affecting a lot of authors, and, you know, trying to figure out how, you know what recourse they have, if any, since this person is, you know, has spent the money or whatnot and is going to jail for 20 years.
If it's approached as a civil matter, obviously, which is where money comes into play, I'd also be worried, and it depends on how you negotiate your contract, that there's probably an arbitration clause in there too, in addition to like any sort of mediation or getting together of the parties. But if you've got some arbitration language in your contract, you know, you may not be able to sue on certain things.
Right.
And so, you know, if you were really convinced that there was an issue, and you wanted to talk to an attorney, you know, you'd want to make sure, obviously, you bring that contract and see if they think that, you know, that you could file a suit. Certainly, you know, it's cost is going to be an issue. So, you know, unless there's a lot of money involved, that's always the problem with attorneys. Unless there's a lot of money involved, you know, it's tough to fight certain things just because you may win the battle but lose the war when it ends up. But yeah, I'd be worried that you might arbitrate it anyway.
Right. I mean, you know, for instance, I mean, a lot of these authors that were going through this literary agency, they found out about it from the New York Post when the New York Post broke the story. I mean, they had no idea it was even going on until they were informed by the Post that, oh, hey, did you know that your literary agency has been robbed of $3.4 million and it could affect your royalty? You know, so
the only other thought is that if it happens to a lot of authors, they certainly need to band together if they've got common agents perhaps or other common resources. But yeah, if it's happened to numerous authors, that certainly would make it more economically feasible if you've got several folks in the same boat.
Right.
Well, you'd have that plus your agent and stuff should, you know, be able to pull up that same information that the house has.
Right, and I know that for instance, if you're a member of a writer organization, like I know that the Horror Writers Association has a legal fund and things of that nature, so you might have the ability to access that to assist you as well.
Well, this is fascinating. I'm just sitting here back listening to this. This is definitely some good information. And as far as, we've inspired Tommy in the chat room, by the way. Just so you know, Eric, you're having an effect. Well, one of the phrases that Tommy uses a lot with himself, he's thinking he should snap it up before Gene Simmons, or he should get it trademarked before Gene Simmons snaps it up. Yeah, that's a reference. That's a reference to Gene Simmons' effort to trademark the rock and roll hand sign, I think it was. So that I can't remember exactly. I think that was it, was it? But it was.
I'm telling you, Daniel, Ripper World, it trademarked.
Ripper World,
well,
yes.
Something else I'd like to mention, if we've got a couple more minutes.
Yeah, we got about 10, I think.
Okay. The another aspect of it, so we've got the real-life legal stuff, which, again, you know, a lot of folks kind of figure it doesn't really affect you until you get, you know, big enough to have those issues. But, like, just for example, I'm pirated left and right. I know you guys probably are, too. And so even small folks, normal folks have these legal issues. And it's tough to figure out whether to fight or whether to try to perhaps be more, quote, pragmatic and just kind of keep writing. But I also wanted to talk briefly about lawyers in your books as well. Because just like I think anybody who has a job that they love and that they've worked hard for, when they see members of their profession on TV, in a TV show or in a book or in a movie, there are some things that make you just want to say to yourself, they did no research whatsoever, and I'm sort of insulted. And, you know, it can actually kind of ruin the experience for you. And I've certainly, you know, read a few books with lawyers in them and certainly seen some TV shows where I kind of had that same sort of reaction. And I was going to throw out a couple easy tips if you're going to have a lawyer in any of your books.
Please do.
Go for it.
I'm going to keep this as general as possible because I think that, you know, obviously most people are not going to write legal thrillers, but, you know, lawyers pop up, you know, crime fiction, you know, with thrillers, and they can pop up anywhere. They can pop up, you know, with a, you know, you know, family, you know, everybody's fighting over an estate or some stories like that. So they could pop up pretty much in any story. And so some things I was going to kind of have bullet points here was, number one, lawyers or law can be a great, you know, theme or, you know, something to throw in as a smaller plot because, you know, you automatically have the conflict. It brings the conflict with the area. So if you bring a legal issue in to a book, that probably means you've got something people are fighting over. So you get to explore the stakes and their approaches to how they resolve problems and who wants it more, and all that sort of thing. So it's a great thing to consider if you want to have another sort of plot running alongside your main plot. Dumb it down a little for your audience, but try not to dumb it down so much that you're insulting people who have some knowledge of the area. And I think that's a tough balance. One thing I think that works pretty well is to include some scenes where the lawyers are explaining things to their clients in the book. So you have the lawyer dumbing it down, so to speak, for an authentic reason. They are talking to their client. You know, they're explaining what happened in court or how the judge ruled. And so the reader is getting that sort of slightly less legalese, you know, form of what happened, but you're also telling the reader that you understand what really happened and you're able to, you know, communicate it in a way that's more appropriate for a general audience without dumbing it down too much. You know, if you have questions about, you know, would a lawyer do this or what's a lawsuit like, most people know an attorney in their daily life, I think. And most all attorneys I've met would love to have lunch with you. And they may or may not bill it, but they'd love to have lunch with you and answer questions. So there's plenty of resources out there. Lawyers specialize. So if you have an attorney, unless they live in like the middle of nowhere, they probably don't do everything. So it's like a doctor sort of. They probably have an area or two. So I wouldn't have an attorney, you know, doing multiple things for somebody. You know, unless you're like have a very kind of country rural type of setting. And then two more things. Cases, any kind of legal case, whether it's a lawsuit or whether it's something else, like maybe a will type situation, it takes a long time. So, you know, TV shows make it ridiculously fast. So just think about pacing. If you're going to have a legal issue alongside your other issues, it's not going to be wrapped up, you know, very quickly. So hopefully you've got a story that extends over a period of time. If you've got a story that takes place in over a week, you know, nothing realistically is going to happen with a case in a week, so you probably wouldn't want to include that. And then finally, getting back to my stories I've written, maybe give it, if you're going to use the law as a central part of your story, other than certainly talking to an attorney or two or three, try to give it a little bit of a spin or twist. I mean, some people like to write about, you know, things like, you know, animals, for example, or they like to write about kids or military or any kind of little niche of religion or politics. And, you know, the law intersects with everything. So, you know, try to give it a twist. Like my series, which I don't think I even named at the beginning of this show, but it's called Community College Hero. And basically, the law that I have inside the story is kind of like law that would apply if we had, you know, superheroes running around. Like, what would the criminal statutes look like? And how would the police treat stuff? And what would happen if a superhero, you know, destroys your car while they're trying to stop a bad guy, and all the little intersections of that. And a lot of folks have, of all the elements of the stories, the fact that there's the main characters are in a school and they have a course kind of on the basics of superhero law. And I've gotten a ton of responses as to that because folks really like the sort of intersection of those two things.
Well, like one thing that I had to learn when writing Victorian was the difference in between like a magistrate, a coroner, and a surgeon when it came to what, you know, who gave information to the court about the bodies that they found and stuff like that. And you
was, that in Great Britain or?
Yeah. And, you know, 1800s, you know, London and stuff, you know, who actually gave information. And until I talked to another author that had studied all about law and legal and everything like that in that time period, I didn't have a clue that, you know, that the magistrate did this and, you know, the coroner did this and the surgeon did this part. You know, you would think that, you know, whoever looked at the body would be the one that would be giving information to the court, but that's not the case.
Well, and you going into that automatically makes me react and think that that's probably reads as an authentic scene there. You having done that research, because I find that, because I don't know the specifics of what you're talking about, I find it very interesting.
Yeah, that, you know, it's all on, you know, what the different people did at that time period. And, you know, there's some really good books out there about it and stuff that, you know, I was able to get a hold of and read some of them. And then, you know, going on the internet, finding old books about legal practices and stuff like that. But that's just something else that you need to, you know, be sure of who actually is going to be giving testimony as an authentic witness or something in a case when it comes to lawyers and stuff like that.
And I will caution that, like, real trials are mind-numbingly boring. So, like, if someone tries to write a trial scene, by their very nature, you can't really write it out like it would happen. It would read like a transcript, and that would be horribly boring. So there is an art, I think, to making, you know, adding those authentic elements, but certainly, you know, skipping some of the perfunctory, you know, just sort of bland elements, and kind of sticking to the more exciting elements of the trial. Even a murder trial is boring to watch the whole thing.
They don't have least, like My Cousin Vinny.
that might be taking it too far.
At least until Eric gets up there in a Colonel Sanders style suit to give the closing arguments in a dramatic feature film moment. You know, that we can make it exciting. Don't worry. Oh. Yeah, the filmmakers can always jazz it up, Eric. Don't worry.
That's why the book needs to be pretty reasonable, because they will take their liberties, won't they?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, we're coming up on, it looks like, 2 minutes that we've got left. So I do want to give you some time, Eric. You've given us some fantastic information. We hopefully haven't driven you crazy yet, but give us some ways for people to find you online and follow you.
Well, first of all, I really appreciate y'all having me on. I would probably like to do this again sometime. This has been really fun, and I
absolutely
love the show. Yeah.
You are official, frankly, Star Chamber Show Legal Eagle. We're going to even give you a little moniker.
I can check that off my list. The my website, I used to be branded by my book, Community College Hero, and actually I took the advice from Imaginarium last year on the branding class. I took it to heart, and so I rebranded as Eric Moser, and then so I have a new website. It's called Fiction by Eric Moser, and so I have a lot of stuff on there. I've got you know, links to my work, and I have a lot of side projects. I have a comic strip that I'm working with an artist on, and that is on fictionbyericmoser.com. I'm on Facebook, and again, fictionbyericmoser.com. I'm on Twitter, again, same branding on Twitter as well. And then I also started a Patreon page, and maybe that's something we'll talk about at Imaginarium again, because I have started with that, and it's funny, those are your super readers, the folks who really want supplemental content between major releases, that want the short stories, that want the, in my case, the comic strip and role-playing sheets of characters and all sorts of supplemental content that you would love to make as a creator, but at the same time, you can't just do it for free because it's a losing proposition. But the chance to make supplemental content between your main stories is, to me, just a huge plus. And so I've spent a little bit of time on there. But again, the website, Twitter, and Facebook are all Fiction by Eric Moser.
Well, thank you very much.
Good,
yeah, that's appreciate having you, and definitely want you back soon. And definitely Patreon will be a great topic to actually make a bit of a show out of too. But yeah, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back next week. Of course, every week at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So yeah, be sure to check out the Star Chamber Show. And Michael and Daniel, you have comments to sign off, and we'll close this out.
Go ahead, Michael.
All right. Okay, well, you can find me at bymichaelwest.com, and thanks to everyone who has downloaded my ebooks recently, and you can find them on Amazon, iTunes, Books, Barnes & Noble, and Kubo.
And Daniel? You can find me on BookBub and as of today, and Smashwords, and also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the major places to buy books, or on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and all the rest of them under Daniel Dark. So just look for me in all the places of normal wear and tear, and we will see you next week.
Let's go make some catsup, everybody. Victorian style. Good night, everybody.
Yes, sir.
Night.
Night.